Okay, I have 3 o'clock on my clock, so we can now begin. Usually do a Namo Tassa first of all. You're welcome to join in. Homage to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So for those of you who have been to this class before, as you know that on a Friday night we keep it just quite broad, so people who've never been to a Buddhist place before can actually feel welcome. And then Saturday afternoon we do the meditation, which is much deeper. And also on the Sutta class we go right to the word of the Buddha. Now these teachings of the Buddha, we always have to be careful that the source which we use is the Pali Sutta Pitaka. But even there, you find that unless you know those ancient languages, the Pali, that sometimes the translations can make a huge amount of difference. And so that the particular text which I'm using was a text called The Word of the Buddha, originally compiled by Venerable Ñāṇitilloka over 100 years ago. And the translation was good, but it can be improved, and also we can use the form of translation which learned from Professor A.K. Warder. You never translate words, you translate sentences, phrases. And the one which I often quote is, many people who come here and learn English, they get amused by the saying, when a heavy downpour, it rained cats and dogs. And of course, if you see that, it rained cats and dogs, that is not a good translation. It's word for word. I have been through many storms, and I've never seen a cat or a dog falling from the sky. What it means is it rained heavily. You translate the phrase, not the words. And that is something which I have used throughout this retranslation of the word of the Buddha. And of course, I've been around a long time, so I use my years as a monk, meditation teachings, understanding of Pali to be able to work with this. And it does open it up to many, many very clear, and of course I would maintain, accurate translations, renderings, which makes it very powerful. Now where we're going now, I've gone through the Eightfold Path. We're coming now just at the end of the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is the right mindfulness. And we started off with the mindfulness from the Satipatthana Sutta, and there's also the Anapanasati Sutta. And if you just look at one sutta in isolation, then sometimes you just can very easily not sort of tie in to all the other teachings of the Buddha. And I would take the opportunity to just to mention respectfully that very recently there was a monk in Thailand who passed away. That's Venerable Ñānananda of Concept and Reality. And just after I went to see him in Mitrigala, many years ago, that then I went to up to the Kandy, where I was very, very fortunate to be able to spend a nice afternoon talking with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi and Venerable Ñānaponika, the one who translated many of the texts, and also Ñānaramita, the three of them there. It was a very wonderful visit. And it was there that Venerable Ñānaponika, actually with reference to Venerable K. Ñānananda, who said something very profound, which I've always kept in mind. And he said, you should never interpret the whole of the teachings of the Buddha in terms of one or two obscure passages. Instead, you see the obscure passages, the ones which are ambiguous, you should interpret those in light of the huge amount of teachings of the Buddha. So people trying to get a little bit of an angle here, an angle there, sometimes take passages which are ambiguous and then turn them around, and the whole mass of teachings of the Buddha interpreted through that. And I always remember that warning, because Venerable Nyanaponika, very, very old, he would die a little time afterwards, and a very, very wonderful monk. So anyway, here, Nibbana through Anapanasati. This is 118 of the Majjhima Nikaya. And here we go. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. Sometimes people translate it as the four foundations of mindfulness. I prefer the four focuses of mindfulness, because that's where one puts the mindfulness on. When the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, no enlightenment. Now, the main powerful teaching there is that Anapanasati is the same as Satipatthana. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. Anapanasati equals Satipatthana. And I say that because it's controversial, because there's a whole school of meditation which seems to say that Satipatthana is something you do after Anapanasati, and that it is separate, and that it is the only way, which early on I said was untenable. It's a very inaccurate translation, and even the commentaries agree on that. So here we have first point, Anapanasati equals Satipatthana. You do mindfulness of breathing, it fulfills. So said the Buddha. And it leads all the way to enlightenment. So it's not an Anapanasati, it's a second class meditation, or second class path to enlightenment. Anapanasati can lead all the way to full enlightenment. So anyway, this is the Buddha giving the introduction in a good way of teaching. This is what I'm going to say. Now he explains it and then sums it up at the end. Mindfulness of breathing completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And how does mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated complete the four focuses of mindfulness? When the in-breath and the out-breath are long, and you are aware that they are long, when the in-breath and the out-breath are short, and you are aware that they are short, when you learn to experience the hold of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body. Having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful, in and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category bodies. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. Now, even that, there are some passages which people still argue with. The first of it is, first of all, you can see that I've shortened. Now, if you look at that in the original, they say breathing in, you are aware that you're breathing in an in-breath, breathing in a short breath. When breathing out short, you're breathing an out short. It's just so much repetition, which drives people to sleep. So, this is how we translate. Get the essence, be accurate, 100% accurate, and shorten it. And the other thing to notice is you're aware of the in-breath and out-breath as long or short of the first two, and then you learn to experience the whole of the breath and to calm the breath. It's a learning, a training for the next two stages. Now, on this occasion, you are mindful of the body. That is the Satipatthana. The first stage is the body awareness. And having restrained the five hindrances, That's such an important point, which I've mentioned before, but it's been a while since I taught the word of the Buddha. The words in Pali are Lokiya Bija Domanasang. They mean, they're usually translated, the usual translation is have abandoned covetousness and grief for the world. Which is, again, not an accurate translation, and even worse, it's meaningless. When it's time to do the questions. When it's the time, I'll invite people to ask the questions. And the meaningless, and it's also, when you look in the commentaries, and again, you look at the whole of the suttas, and especially if you read the Anguttara Nikaya in Pali, that's the numerical sayings translation in English. You'll see there that so many times, for the first hindrance, it's usually called Kamachanda in Pali, they have a synonym for it, Lokiya Bija. And so when I was reading this, Kamachanda, Lokiya Bija, they were used interchangeably in the whole list of the five hindrances. Sometimes they start with Lokiya Bija instead of Kamachanda. It's an alternative. A synonym, meaning the same thing. And then afterwards looked in the commentaries to the two Satipatthana suttas, Mahasatipatthana in the Dīgha Nikāya and then the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikāya, and see there the commentaries. They also pick up on that and say, Vinaya Lokiya Bija Domanasang does mean having restrained the five hindrances. And that, you know, brings the whole of the path together when you look at Satipatthana Sutta and the rest of the Eightfold Path. It makes so much sense. You cannot be really mindful. You cannot really see what's really to be seen if these five hindrances are really active. If you are restless, of course, you know, you can't see anything. You just over here, over there, all over the place. If you're fast asleep, again, dullness and drowsiness mean you can't see much. The first two, wanting and aversion, ask any psychologist. You see only what you want to see. And aversion means you just blot out, you deny what's too troubling for you. So this is actually how the five hindrances throughout the whole of the rest of the teachings of the Buddha always are what stops one seeing clearly. Also, we have the fifth hindrance of doubt, where not enough confidence to follow a path long enough without being restless, doubt, asking questions. So, those five hindrances, this is what the commentary understands, this is what is very valid, because this is how the Buddha was teaching these things. The first factors of the path, from right view, right intention, and or right motivation, I usually say, and down to speech, action, and livelihood, and then the endeavor. All of those have a purpose to weaken those five hindrances, not to abandon them, to weaken them enough so when you are mindful, you have a good idea that what you're seeing is pretty accurate. Not 100%, but not bad. So this is where that particular part, having weakened or restrained the five hindrances. Energized, fully aware of the purpose, which is sampajana, it's really important. Why are you doing this? And mindful. And the next part is, we still have people sort of doubting that in the third of the stages of anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, when you experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. The word is sabbakaya. And again, just like it rained cats and dogs means, you know, it rained heavily, doesn't mean cats and dogs fall from the sky. The same as kaya. Kaya means body. In the same, you have a body of troops, you have a body of evidence. Even in Pali, you have manokaya, you have indriyakaya. They're just a body of indriyas. It just means a grouping, a collection of stuff. And so it doesn't always refer to the physical body. in the same way that Spam. When I grew up, Spam was a luncheon meat, which we ate because we were poor. And these days, Spam is what appears on your computer. And so if you don't know what you're talking about, sometimes you say, oh, luncheon meat was on my computer today. And I and that's the trouble if you don't sort of look at these words. And of course, what really proves the point is where the Buddha said, in and out breathing, the breath is regarded by the Buddha as a body. This is what it means as a body. And that's so clear there. So, and the next obviously thing is just nature. If you want to get peaceful, calm, then if you're just watching the breath, an in-breath, an out-breath, long or short, and then you have to go to your body, it's not getting any tranquility there, not any peace. And it's nature that even if you don't follow instructions, but you follow nature, the way to things calm down, of course, when you breathe in and out, and then when you do calm down, your mindfulness increases, of course you can see the whole of the beginning of the in-breath to the end of the out-breath, in-breath, the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, it's the whole body of the breath. And you calm. That is body awareness. That is one example of it that is sufficient. Now, any questions on that so far?
So we restrain the five hindrances, we don't drop them, we don't practice right effort?
We do practice the right endeavor. The endeavors are restrainings. The next presentation of the word of the Buddha, you will see the gradual training. And this is parallel to the Eightfold Path. And there you will see, just after developing just some mindfulness, then one practices sense restraint to abandon the hindrances and get into the jhanas. It's restraining. So that's practice of the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, is we're trying to get a word like restraint, sort of saying no to stuff. And that's why sometimes trying to find a good translation, still haven't found a good translation for that word yet, an English version, it means the effort to say no, the effort to restrain, the effort to drop. That is what's meant by the effort. Not to go and get something, but to let something go. So anyway, that's where the restraint. So the first factors of the Eightfold Path, you've got your right view, the intention, what you're doing this for, and then to see the virtue, the right speech, action, and livelihood. They tend to dry up just the fuel for the hindrances. When you restrain yourself through the precepts, of course that weakens those hindrances quite enormously. And then obviously you can weaken them more through this through sense restraint. And then you're ready for the Satipatthana, having restrained the five hindrances. Not abandoned them, that comes later, but restrained them. Any other questions, sir? Okay, let's keep going to the next one. So, that was the first Satipatthana, body awareness. Now, this is 5, 6, 7, 8 of Anapanasati. When you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience the mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out, that's joy and pleasure, when you learn to calm this mental formation of piti sukha as you breathe in and out, on that occasion you are mindful of experience as vedana. Having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, for being mindful of the pleasure associated with this state of the breath meditation is being mindful of experience. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. Now there's a lot of really important points in this. First, you learn to experience the joy and the pleasure of meditation. It's a training. And of course, I've mentioned many times how that training works. And sometimes, you know, if you haven't even learnt it, and when it happens, you're actually enjoying your meditation. It's common, simply because you are not wasting your energy fighting, striving, and you're becoming bright and happy. And it's the nature, first of all, it's part of the path. You're supposed to experience the joy and the pleasure. It's not something you should be afraid of and think this is attachment, this must be bad, I'm enjoying something. And it happens. And you experience the mental formation. And that's another important point. This is the citta sankhara. This is come from the mind. It's not inherent in the breath. The breath is just the breath. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, to make it sort of very strong. You've all heard me giving that similes of going to the toilet and seeing the most beautiful piece of, and I'm not going to say the word because out of respect to everybody. But, you know, it's amazing if you can see in what most people think is actually disgusting, you know, the contents of a toilet bowl, number two, then it's amazing that just this is not inherent in that object. It is a citta sankhara. It is just how the mind can look at it. Coming from the mind, from the citta. So that is how you train yourself to have this mind which gets so strong and powerful that you can actually see the joy and the pleasure in the breath really easy. And after a while you look at it and it's just wonderful to behold. Enjoyable, delightful, natural. Now of course that is why people can meditate for long periods of time, because they're enjoying it. And also this is part of the Satipatthana. The Buddha specifically said it is mindful of the Vedana. And it's also, you learn to calm this mental formation of piti, sukha as you breathe in and out. What that really means is the mental formation of peace and joy gets very stable. Instead of just, you know, going all over the place, joy, but very peaceful, very powerful. And then, of course, we'll see what happens next. This is being mindful of the pleasure associated with this state of the breath meditation, is being mindful of experience. So, any questions on those four stages? Vedanasati. Yes?
I was just wondering if you could help differentiate a bit more the difference between enjoying something and attaching to it. Mm-hmm. I must admit I have trouble with that.
Yes, I know, because people have been brainwashed into thinking attachments are bad. So you don't even just question, you know, just what that really says, what that really means. The Buddha gave the wonderful simile of the raft. And the raft, you know, is for crossing from this side to the other side. And he said, you know, once you get to the other side, then you don't carry the raft with you. You drop it there once you reach the bank. But you don't drop the raft in the middle of the stream or the middle of the lake. So the raft has got a purpose for it. And while it has a purpose, you attach to it. You make use of it. And just because it's joyful doesn't mean it's attachment. So sometimes, when especially you look at the cause of that joy, where it actually is coming from, is as you're training yourself, you're learning how this happens. This comes from the restraint, from letting go. It doesn't come from seeking these things out, chasing them, and holding on to them. You see me do this simile so many times, I go through it very quickly. How can I keep water perfectly still in a glass, grasping it, attaching to it, never gets still. No matter how much mindfulness and effort I put into it, it will always be moving. The only way to get water to be still is to let it go. It's letting go, it becomes still. That's what happens with the mind. These are stages of letting go. The more you let go, the more you detach, the more joy comes up. So it's, the English word is oxymoron. Now, two words which go together, which means the opposite of one another. For example, like crazy wisdom. You're either crazy or you're wise. Not both. So this particular one is... what's the other ones they have? Government accountability? I better stop pretty quick before I go any further there. So, I better, I'm going into dangerous territory. But in this particular case, the attachment and the letting go, how can you really be attached to letting go? Letting go means the opposite of attachment. Attachment means the opposite of letting go. So it's letting go creates that joy. And if you try to attach to it, so if you really want it and you hold on to it, it vanishes, you destroy it. Which shows you that in no way can you attach to such things. Many people experience joy and bliss in meditation and they want it back again. And they can't get it. So this is why we learn that this is a letting go. And it's not the happiness born of attachment. It's the happiness born of letting go. Yeah?
Can you just say again the difference between experiencing pleasure and experiencing the mental formation of pleasure?
Yeah, okay. Experiencing pleasure, experiencing the joy. It's recognizing that this is not... the breath being joyful, it's actually just how you look at the breath. It's what you add. It's formed by the mind. It's not inherent. You know when, probably Shakespeare said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. He said the piti sugha is in the jitta, the mind, of the meditator. And that was, you know, one of the wonderful things which you experience on retreats. Once your mind gets really, really powerful, just everything looks beautiful. You know, the flowers, the trees, the stars are incredible. And of course, your breath is so easy to watch. It's delightful. This is one of the reasons why, how can a person just practice the breath meditation? You know, it's boring. Sit there, watch your breath for a couple of hours. You know, you must be... either asleep, but you're not asleep, you're energized, as it says down here. And it's also that you are having a wonderful time. Because it's training the mind to be so still, so powerful, the breath looks gorgeous. That is how people meditate for long periods of time. Because they're having fun. And of course, it doesn't stop there. It just gets even deeper. So, the next, so that's Vedanusati. And now when you learn to experience the citta as you breathe in and out. And that is how you experience the citta. In many places it's called citta nimitta, or sometimes called samadhi nimitta. It is a sign of the mind. As you breathe in and out, when you learn to brighten the nimitta, bringing joy to the citta as you breathe in and out, when you learn to settle the nimitta, still the citta as you breathe in and out, when you learn to enter the jhanas, liberate the citta as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the citta, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. I do not say that there is development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull, who is not fully aware. And that's fully aware, it always means reaching the jhana with the hindrances gone. That is called the pinnacle of awareness, the purity of awareness, that's one of the epithets of the fourth jhana. That is why on that occasion the meditator abides mindful of the mind, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. So it's aware of the citta, the mind. And of course, to be aware of that mind, to really be aware of anything, which is always called the sixth sense, the other five senses having sort of subsided. That means that either the sight, sound, smell, taste, touch are either totally gone, or at the very least, they're just so weakened. Like many people meditating, yeah, they can hear sounds, but like 100 miles away. Yeah, it's not 100 miles away, but you feel like distance from things. And the body is so comfortable, you can hardly feel it. And all of these five senses are just so calmed down that, the sixth sense, the nimitta, can arise. And that nimitta, as it's often said, that this mind is pabhasara, the pabhasara citta, when the defilements, the hindrances are absent. And that's what happens. And many people just discuss what does this pabhasara, this radiant mind, actually look like. And it's obvious if you get into the nimittas meditations, then of course it's beautiful, incredibly radiant mind. Only when the hindrances are just either really, really restrained or almost not there. So it's a good sort of bringing all of those teachings together from many places for the consistency, not interpreting sort of any sutta, any passages on its own where it could be ambiguous, but taking in the whole of the massive consistent teachings of the Sutta Pitaka. And there you see it. So that this is the citta, and of course this is, if you're going to be fully aware of the citta, the mind, at least up to this stage here. Where it says they call it first of all sampasadanang, the citta. And it's a very beautiful word, the pasada. It's a combination of meaning like confidence, trust, but also like joy and happiness. And many of you who have come from Malaysia, you know what's a palace called? Pasat. Where the sultans live. Istana. Okay, there's another one there. This is another palace. Is the Pasada. It's also the place where Migawamata Pasada, that she built. Migawamata, as you all know, was Visakha, and that she, was out going to a big function, and she decided instead to go and see the Buddha. And so she was wearing all her jewelry, so she put her jewelry aside and just went to see the Buddha, because it was not appropriate to see the Buddha dressed up in so much expensive stuff. And then she got so inspired, she went home forgetting her expensive jewelry. And Ananda found it. And, monk, you're not supposed to pick up money or expensive things, so he asked the Buddha, what should I do? And he said, if it is things which is lost in the temple, or if it's lost in a house you're visiting at the time, then you can pick it up to keep it for the person who lost it. So Ananda went and picked it up, because he knew it was from Visakha, and then gave it back to Visakha. And Visakha said, oh my goodness, this has been touched by a holy monk. Therefore, and now it's not appropriate for me to accept it, but what I will do, I will give a donation so I can get it back again. And so her donation was to build the Migawamata Pasada. That's where it came from. So it's a bit of a long story, but there we go. And then that became the residence of many, many monks. It's like a beautiful, beautiful construction. So this is meaning just a beautiful place. It's Sampasada. It also means like confidence, finding joy in something. And so this is where we have enough confidence, if you like, in the nimitta. We can leave it alone. We find joy in it, which also allows us to let it be. And then it can become brighter and brighter, more and more joyful. And also then to still it, that's samadhang, to settle it. So it becomes still and also very radiant, very powerful. As many of you know, that sometimes you're sitting there and that nimitta is as brighter than the sun. How do you think you go blind? We never go blind. Maybe that's why I'm wearing glasses. I don't know. That's only a joke. No, it just gets very, very, very powerful. And it doesn't affect us. It's in the mind's eye, not your physical eye. So that's the limiter things. And then, of course, the last one is that it'll liberate the mind. And that liberation is always meant the entering of the jhanas. So, the next, anything about that one? Okay, next four. When you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation, when you learn to explore things fading away in breath meditation, when you learn to explore things ceasing in breath meditation, when you learn to explore relinquishing things in breath meditation, on these occasions you are mindful of mind objects. The Dharma, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, having seen with impermanence fading away, having seen with wisdom, the impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment of the five hindrances, you are mindful with equanimity. That is why on that occasion you are mindful of mind objects, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. That is how mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated completes the four focuses of mindfulness. Now here, you may note that the term of to contemplate, that to me was always too much thinking. And look, quite honestly, that after you get into a deep meditation, it's just almost impossible to think. And okay, I always have to check myself and I'm not making claims or anything, but I already told you that when I went on that 6-month silent retreat, and when I came out of that, I had to, people were asking me, just, Ajahn Brahm, what happened? What do you do? What did you experience? And I had to think, because I had to talk. And quite frankly, that was such a difficult thing to do. And I had to force yourself to think. Not like, most people, you have to force yourself to keep quiet. This was totally opposite. And I had a headache for 3 days. I remember just making my brain think again. So this is not thinking. It's the word which I like now is explore. And I mentioned to you where this comes from, exploring. I use a glass again. You explore, what is this? I'm not going to spend too much time on this. What is it I'm holding up? And say, explore it. Come on, explore it. What is it? You don't just say glass. You say many, many, many things. Now, one of the things I found a great use for glass, I have to take the water away first of all. Sometimes you see a bug. And you can't squash the bug. You're Buddhist. But these are great. You see the bug, and you put a card underneath, and you take it out without killing it. So there's many uses of a glass. So there's like a Buddhist bug catcher. It works very well. So you're exploring what this really is. So it's not contemplating it, but exploring it. Contemplating it, using thoughts, will always be using old descriptions. Names and labels, which, they have their limitations. So exploring impermanence in breath meditation. And of course, what anicca means, impermanence. I think I've put this somewhere else on this word of the Buddha. Impermanence doesn't mean rise and fall. That's just not really seeing the depth of these great teachings of the Buddha. It's why it rises, why it comes into existence, and why it vanishes away. What are the causes? And the simile was of the flame. It's not just seeing a flame flicker, it's seeing the flame go out. Nibbana is the word for flame going out. You see it being lit again. How does the flame come into existence? How does it cease? And of course, the thing is with the wax, the wick, and the heat. I've said that many times. Those three things come together, and then there's a flame. The wax just is all used up, the wick burns out, or the wind blows the flame away, blows the heat away. Any one of those causes is taken away, there's no flame. That is impermanence. The rise and the fall, where it comes from. You're not seeing things flicker, you're seeing things disappear. You know, again, where that comes from is the where I learned Pali was from the Vinaya. And the Vinaya was all those rules all came from real experiences in life. There's even one of the rules that the monk is not allowed to tickle another monk. It's one of the rules, and the reason is because they had these really naughty monks. They're called a group of six. If ever you read that, you come across this all the time. And just, they got one of these very young monks, the childish monks, a group of 17, and they tickled him, and he couldn't breathe, and he died. You know, tickled to death, literally. And that was 2,500 years ago. So because of that, Buddha said, you know, you can't tickle a monk. So that's one of the 227 rules. But where was I going with this one? Oh, yeah. You get the ordinary life stories, and that's where you got the ordinary life story of someone who was giving food regularly and then decided to stop. And that regular type of food was called nitya food. It's the opposite of anicca. Nitya, regular, reliable, comes every Monday, as Grace used to do when she was really healthy, still comes. You go to Nun's Monastery, Dharmasara, so every Tuesday or something. That is called nitya food, regular food. You know, so we know they're coming sort of, you know, once a week or once a month. Anicca means what is regular, what was always there, stops. It's really powerful. So you explore what is impermanence in breath meditation. Breath, gone, vanished. You explore things fading away in breath meditation. Your hindrances fading away, five senses fading away, sound getting further and further away until it fades. You can't hear anything. And things ceasing in breath meditation, which is the real cool stuff. So you're sitting there and the breath has ceased. That's how many of you have just, I don't put your hand up or anything, but many of you have been meditating there and you can't find the breath. You don't need to. It ceased. You don't die. You're just having a great time. So it ceases. Many other things cease in breath meditation. You can't feel your legs. You can't feel your skin. And of course, many other things cease as well. Just some of the sloth and torpor, the restlessness, things stop. Even time ceases in the breath meditation when you get very, very deep. And when you learn to experience relinquishing things in breath meditation, what have you relinquished? What have you let go of? Especially you've let go of controlling stuff, of being in command, of being the driver. You're exploring this, what it means just to let go. Because you've done a huge amount of letting go. That is what is meant here. Okay. Pause. Comments, questions. Okay. Continue then. So that's the four focuses of mindfulness are completed, said the Buddha, by the mindfulness of the breath. Now, the four focuses of mindfulness complete the seven enlightenment factors. How do the four focuses of mindfulness develop and cultivate and complete the seven enlightenment factors? When you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, on that occasion steady mindfulness is established in you. On whenever occasion steady mindfulness is established in you, on that occasion the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You just get mindfulness as something really important. It doesn't complete it yet, because it says you develop it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment in you. When you are thus mindful, you explore the Dhamma with wisdom. On every occasion, abiding thus mindful, you explore the Dhamma with wisdom. On that occasion, the exploration of Dhamma, enlightenment factor, is aroused in you. And you develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. When you explore the Dhamma with wisdom and embark upon a full inquiry into it, unflagging energy is aroused. On whatever occasion unflagging energy is aroused, as you explore the Dhamma with wisdom, on that occasion the energy, enlightenment factor, is aroused in you. And you develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in you. When you have aroused energy, unworldly joy. The word actually is niramisa. It means the joy which has nothing to do with worldly joy, like your football team wins, or that, you know, your granddaughter has a baby son. Or what else can you get? You won the lotto. Or whatever other worldly joys there is in this world. This is something of a totally different nature. It's pure because it's not gained on getting something. It is comes from letting go of something. That's why it's called unworldly. So when you, on that occasion, unworldly joy arises. On whatever occasion unworldly joy arises, on that occasion the joy enlightenment factor is aroused in you. And you develop it. You develop the joy. On that occasion, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. When you experience unworldly joy, I love this one, your body and mind become tranquil. So often people think that the only way to get tranquility of body is effort. Come on, sit still, don't move, stop fidgeting. That doesn't work. But when you've really got lots of joy, your body becomes still, effortlessly still. When your body is tranquil, on whatever occasion the body... Are we... Oh, sorry. When you experience unworldly joy, your body and mind become tranquil. On whatever occasion the body and mind become tranquil, you experience joy. On that occasion, the tranquility enlightenment factor is aroused in you, and you develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. Why does the body move? Because it wants to find a more happy posture. Why does the mind move and fantasize and plan and complain? Because it's not happy. If the body is happy and the mind is happy, you don't want to move. You're having a great time. You're just there and enjoying it. We've got a couple of nuns outside. Okay, anyway, a couple of nuns are doing something out there. And when your body is tranquil and you feel pleasure in the mind becomes still. On whatever occasion the mind becomes still and joyful, on that occasion the stillness enlightenment factor is aroused in you. And you develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in you. Again, stillness coming from happiness. This is one of those little phrases I say often, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiyati. It is from happiness the mind becomes still. When you're having a wonderful time in meditation, your body becomes really still, and your mind doesn't want to go anywhere. Totally gets still. And on that occasion, the stillness enlightenment factor is aroused in you, and you develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. Of course, you all know what the stillness in Pali is. Samadhi. And you observe such a still mind with equanimity. On whatever occasion you observe with equanimity the still mind, on that occasion, the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused in you, and you develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. And those are the enlightenment factors. You see just how many of them are joyful, happy, still. You're supposed to be smiling when you're meditating and getting somewhere in the meditation. Here you develop the mindfulness in fact, enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, physical and mental, fading away in cessation and ripens in relinquishment. Ripens in relinquishment, which means you don't have stuff in this world. You renounce, because what do you want all this stuff for? So here you develop the mindfulness experience enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, physical and mental fading away, and cessation of arising relinquishment. You develop the exploration of Dharma enlightenment factor, energy, joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, fading away, and cessation of arising in relinquishment. That is how the seven enlightenment factors develop and cultivate a complete true knowledge and deliverance for enlightenment. So that is how the Anapanasati and Satipatthana work together. Any comments on that? Okay, now we go to even more juicy stuff. The jhanas. Here we go. Right stillness, samadhi. Samadhi means stillness, never concentration. That was one of those translations. It's not just, you know, being pedantic, just being picky, because the translations, if you don't get them right, just change the whole practice. And if you don't get that one right, I think it's concentration. People just spend so much time getting frustrated, thinking you've got to really work hard, be concentrated, and then you'll fulfill that factor. But when you call it stillness, it's a totally different idea, and obviously a different way of reaching that stillness by putting things down, letting it go. Concentration comes from effort, hard work. Stillness comes from wise work. If it's effort, many people, when you get old and sick, can't do it. If it is wisdom, you can. Yes?
No, the interpretation of stillness. Can it be something where you just literally can't move?
That is the stillness of the body, but you also have the stillness of the mind. Where you don't want to move.
The mind is just a blank, and you just literally can't move.
Yeah, but that can be not with the joy and the energy and the brightness. So that's also there. But anyway, I'll now go through this right stillness, so it'll make that answer to that good question very, very obvious. So here we go. First of all, the anecdote from the Buddha. I remember the time when my father was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, having passed beyond the five senses and free from unwholesome states, I entered and abided in the first jhana. I thought, could that be the path to enlightenment? Then a realization arose that jhana is indeed the path to enlightenment. That's obviously after he emerged from the jhana. Inside a jhana you can't think. But that was powerful, where the Buddha said, this is a Mahasachaka Sutta. No interpretation here, that's a pretty well accepted translation, that was a path to enlightenment. The four jhanas, what are they? Having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, free from unwholesome states, the hindrances, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves onto the object and holds on to it, the object being the joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. Now, for those people who have experienced out-of-the-body experiences, near-death experiences, or you've seen just people you know, credible accounts of what happens, they always say that once the body is transcended and you go into what they call the mind-made body, then it is just so happy, so free. Joy and pleasure caused by being totally free from the five senses. So that is the cause, that's the origin. A whole lot of suffering has been transcended. This is in the jhana, sitting there, huge joy, huge pleasure, not having to be bothered and disturbed by the affliction of the five senses. It's not that you decide to see, sometimes that you are caused to see. You can't just decide, I'm not going to hear something. You have to hear that. It wasn't your choice. Can you choose not to hear the bell now, please? Use your willpower. So sometimes these senses are just out of control. But here you're totally free from those. And that's a great joy. So that's one of the first, in the first jhana, five things are absent and five factors are present. When one has entered the first jhana, the five hindrances are totally absent. So there's no, it's not restrained, they're gone. There is no wanting. There is no ill will. There is no restlessness. You are still. And there is no sleepiness. You are brighter than you've ever been before, really aware. No sloth and torpor at all. And of course, no doubt, the mind is poised, fixed. Well, the five hindrances are totally present. What is present is the mind moves on to the object, holds on to it, object being the joy and the pleasure, and there is the oneness of the mind. Second jhana. When the mind no longer moves on to the object because it lets go of holding on to it, you enter upon an abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss enough to let go of holding it, and unity of mind without any movement or holding, with the joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. Now, what is happening here is on that first jhana, really blissing out, but there is still the residual little bit of holding. What the commentaries call is the vichara, holding on to it. And because the holding on to it, you haven't totally let go of it yet, that makes it unstable, and it moves away. And it's such an attractive object, vitaka, you go on to it again. It's pretty similar to just what the commentaries say, and just what happens in experience. It's an instability, what I sometimes call the wobble, of the first jhana. Totally automatic, now you don't do anything, but when you let go a little bit more, why do you let go? You have confidence and trust. You feel safe. You don't say to yourself, I'm going to let go. Enough experience of that state that you can just relax into it. Let go into it. Not control it. Not do anything. Enough confidence. Like sometimes, you know, when you're here in this place, you close your eyes, meditating. Sometimes you think, crikey, somebody could creep up on me and throttle me. You know, all your senses, which is supposed to be guarding your security, you know, just, you know, you need a lot of trust and safety to be able to sit meditation and just to close your eyes in a safe, secure place. So you can see just when your senses are really sort of disappearing, it takes a lot of trust. This is safe, it's good, it's going to be very wonderful for you. So this is the trust which goes really to its maximum. Enough for you to, so you don't have to hold on to it, it'll just stay there. And that is without any movement or holding, with the joy and pleasure caused by absolute stillness. You ever really want to go on a holiday where you don't have to do anything? And you go on a holiday and you still think, oh, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, you know, and then you start thinking about the meaning of life or writing your autobiography or whatever else and other things which you're supposed to be doing. But when you can't do anything, it's like your mobile phone has got no reception and your mobile mind has gone offline and you just can't do anything. There's no will left anymore. There's no button you can press to do anything. You're stuck. And that's so blissful, not being able to do anything. Oh, what bliss. The will has disappeared. That is called samadhi, real stillness. That's why it's called the piti sukha, which is born of such samadhi, real stillness. Diamond stillness, doesn't move at all.
You don't want to move. What do you want to move for? Having the time of your existence. Anyway, that's the second jhana. Okay. And then, with the fading away of the joy, you abide mindful and fully aware, experience of bliss purified from joy. You enter upon abiding the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce one has a pleasant abiding indeed who has such mindfulness and equanimity. Making sure it's mindful. You haven't gone to sleep, you're totally mindful. And sometimes to make the point that this is really powerful mindfulness. There's another time when people are really mindful is when they're in danger. They go riding motorbikes at 200 kilometers an hour. Or they go skydiving. The adrenaline going in, you have to be really aware, really alert. Your life is on the line. They do that. Why do they do that? Because they just get like a pressure of being heightened awareness out of fear. But it's also the case, unfortunately, when people have accidents, road accidents, and they have trauma. Trauma, they're so aware. Have you ever had... I remember as a 17-year-old. Actually, I was involved in a car crash when I was 17. Just brakes failed in a car going across the United States. And it happened to you, and just it slows down. Did to me anyway. Actually, twice that's happened when I fell over a cliff once. I've mentioned that many other times. Real. You know, I thought that cliff was about 100 feet. I thought I was dead, man. Because, you know, you fell over a cliff 100 foot. I turned around because I had one of these really old backpacks, you know, in the 1960s, 70s or something. So anyway, just facing this cliff going down, down, down. I thought, this is it, I'm dead. And then, you know, just managed to automatically just bend my legs, roll over, and looked up, and that cliff was only about 10 foot, 9 foot at the most. That really shocked me. Because, to me, I was really highly aware, time had slowed down. The whole perception had been distorted just by just the danger. And of course, those are things you can remember very, very easily. The times you've had a very traumatic experience. So this is trauma, but totally positive. You know, we don't have a word for that. Always looking for a translation, an expression for something which is so powerful, you can't even get it out of your mind. You don't want to get it out of your mind because it's such a beautiful experience. But it has the same power of impressing itself in your head, in your memory, as the bad ones do. Anyway, one does have a pleasant abiding. Sort of the joy part has been refined. And just, you're totally peaceful and happy, but without the joy. And some think, well, what's the point of that? It must be really boring. And then they say that there's still the sukha there. This is a different flavor, a much more refined part of joy. The only similes which I've managed to get up to explain these things is when I was young, I used to like Jimi Hendrix. Really powerful, really sort of loud music. And then later on, he got into sort of classical music. Just, you know, just Vivaldi. And then there was this choral music, Monteverdi, I really got into. Very sort of refined. And then you got into the just, you know, going into the forest and just the sound of the wind in the trees. More and more refined. And then you just go into just the stillness of the mind. You know, each one becomes more refined. So the pity is just, you know, it's really amazing happiness, it's bliss, but there's something even more joyful than that, which is the sukha. And then that vanishes for the fourth jhana to pure equanimity. It is that boring, you know, because sometimes the Buddha calls that upeka sukha, the happiness of no happiness, basically. Now this is not being Zen. This is actually just realizing the more things disappear, the more happy it feels, but totally different flavor, far more refined. So having abandoned pleasure and pain, all Vedana from the five senses, and with the disappearance of joy and unhappiness, all Vedana from the sixth sense except for equanimity, you enter upon the abiding of fourth jhana, which has only neutral mental Vedana, remaining just pure mindfulness with equanimity. So that's what they are. Just in a moment, we just have some of the other statements about the importance of jhana. But before that, any comments? Okay, we go to next thing. And what kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? This is from the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. Because always people ask, did the Buddha recommend vipassana or breath meditation or metta meditation or what type of meditation? And this is obviously, this was Ananda speaking after the Buddha had just passed away. So they were asking, that, you know, people sometimes ask me, what did Ajahn Chah teach? And so this is what they ask Ananda just after the Buddha passed away. What kind of meditation did the Buddha recommend? Totally free from the five senses, you abide in the first jhana. When the mind stops moving on to the joy and pleasure and stops holding it, you abide in the second jhana. With the fading away of joy, you abide in the third jhana. With the abandoning of all mental present and unpleasant vedana, you abide in the fourth jhana. The Buddha only praises four kinds of meditation, the four jhanas. So that's pretty powerful. The Archunda. This is from the Digha Nikaya. This is, these are from Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Four kinds of life devoted to pleasure. Oh, she's not 29. Oh no, this is the Pasadaka Sutta, sorry, not Mahaparinibbana. The four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, though entirely conducive to repulsion, to fading away, cessation, peace, realization, enlightenment, to Nibbana. That's nice. Four kinds of life devoted to pleasure. I mean, when I saw that, which were entirely conducive to Nibbana, I thought, yeah, I'm into that. Devoted to pleasure and enlightenment at the same time. What are they? The four jhanas. So devotees of other sects should say that the Buddhists are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking. They should be told yes. I love that little saying because people say, oh, come on. That's attachment. This is even worse, addiction. They should be said yes, for they will be speaking correctly about you. Then some people might further ask you, what benefits can you expect from a life attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking, the four jhanas? You should reply that they could expect only four fruits, four benefits, stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment, the four stages of enlightenment. These are the benefits that you can expect from being attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking. And again, that's so radical to how many people teach Dhamma and Buddhism, but I really love it. Say, oh, you'll be attached. Yeah, you will. And this is what will happen to you. You get enlightened. That's what you'll get. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Isn't it? Or do you want to be miserable and come around samsara time after time after time? Now, there is only one path, Ananda. Then this is really very clear. One way to the abandoning of the five basic fetters, sometimes we call them lower fetters, and the other one higher fetters, and I didn't like that because no fetter is higher, it's just basic and more advanced. There's one path, Ananda, one way to abandon the five basic fetters. It is impossible. Netang tanang vijati. That means it can't happen. That anyone can understand or abandon these five basic fetters without relying on that path. Let alone abandon, you don't even know what they really mean. No more than it is possible to cut out the heartwood from a tree without cutting through its bark and sapwood. What is that path? The four jhanas and the three immaterial attainments. While you still do not experience, so this is another 68. I remember the sutra in a moment. It's Majjhima 68. When you still do not experience jhana, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade your mind and remain. But when you do experience a jhana, the five hindrances, discontent and weariness, do not invade your mind and remain. This is classical how the five hindrances get suppressed for a long time. And it's also through the weariness and discontent. So you've had a jhana, you can tell when anyone's had a jhana, full of energy, they're bright and bouncy, bushy-tailed, as they say in Australia,
and just lots of energy and no discontent. Okay. When you have no jhana, I'm just pushing this point, but you have to these days. When you have no jhana, for one deficient in jhana, the cause for seeing things as they truly are is destroyed. When you do not see things as they truly are, for one deficient in such wisdom, the cause for repulsion of fading away is destroyed. When you are not repulsed nor inclined to disappearing, for one deficient in these, the cause for knowledge and vision of liberation is destroyed. Develop jhana. When you experience jhana, you can understand things as they really are. And what you understand as it really is, the origin of passing away of form. This is the first kanda, the origin of passing away of experience, vedana. The origin of passing away of perception. The origin of passing away of the will. The origin of passing away of consciousness is. Lastly, there is no jhana for one without wisdom. This is one of my favorite sayings, 372, of Dhammapada. There is no jhana for one without wisdom. Not willpower, wisdom. That's how you get into jhanas. And there's no wisdom for one without jhana. Okay, it looks like a catch-22, but you need a bit of wisdom, bit of samadhi, bit of wisdom, bit of samadhi, they're working together. For one who has both jhana and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbana. It's powerful. Nati jhanang apanyasa, panya nati ajayato, yam hi jhanang cha panya cha sawe nibbana santike. Nibbana santike, they're in the presence, right next door to nibbana. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
On their four immaterial attainments, Ajahn.
Yeah, I never did those yet, because they are special cases of the fourth jhana.
Just said three up there.
Three, because the fourth one is so refined that based on that, you cannot take it as an object for contemplation. Neither perception nor non-perception. It's way too refined. So, but to get there, you have to go through the third immaterial. The third immaterial is based on the second, and the second is based on the first. First is based on the fourth jhana. Fourth is a special case of the third jhana. So, it does still mean you have to go through those early ones first. But that's why the Buddha just get the fourth jhanas. Number four includes those others. Special case. Yes.
Ajahn, I've always been puzzled over this, the 10 filters that we are first exposed to. If you got two kinds of arahant, can we accept there's two types of arahant? The one that is, I know I can't remember the right word, achieved by wisdom, attained by wisdom, and attained by both ways.
If we accept
this scenario of these two types of arahant, I can't see the logic. I'm talking about logic.
True.
You can't have attained by arahant, attained by wisdom, to have to go through the five filters at all.
Yeah, you do. Because if you look at it, that is from Kitagiri Sutta, but it's also explained in many other suttas, especially in Anguttara Nikaya as well. So those two types, the Panya Vimutti and Ubbato Bhayagga Vimutti, arahats. One is both are with the four jhanas. One is with the immaterial attainments. The other one without the immaterial attainments. So the distinction between the two of them is on the immaterial attainments. All of them.
No, I understand this definition from the Sutta that long time ago. My question is, why are we just only being? Most of us. I don't see the need of, let's say, a person that go to graduate to the part of arahant, let's say, is the one that attained by wisdom. Yeah. The attained by, that means the fourth jhana, without the immaterial attainment.
Yeah.
Am I right to say there's such kind of, so if you've got this kind of arahant, the framework, there can be many kind of framework to get enlightenment. The framework where you need to have 10 filters to get into end of avijja and...
Yes.
Is irrelevant the five filters for this type of arahant?
Yeah, it's still relevant for those two types of arahats. It is, I think, the Buddha was just being as complete as possible. And there is a distinction between them, because the first four, they get to this incredible, beautiful state of stillness and equanimity, and then they come out. But their consciousness has not ceased. But with the second type, who actually go into the immaterial, they will go all the way, and they will go to what's called Nirodha Samapatti, which is a cessation of that all the six consciousnesses, and afterwards they will come out again afterwards. They will emerge from that state. And that is the difference. You know, someone who lets go so much that even in this life they can be totally sort of stop and come out afterwards.
From what you just said,
yeah?
There is a number of questions I have to know, but I'll just stop for that.
Okay.
I just want to go back to my question. I accept there is a gradual training, a training. My question is that I can understand we have the five upper, or you call it the five fetters,
the first
attachment
five fetters,
to Rupa and Arupa.
Oh, you mean five?
I know that you can. You will get attached. I sort of, I think logically I can understand you will get attached, provided you got the experience of. Because it's the nature of the mind, the nature of mind is to delight in something, to be happy in something. So if you got jhana, and if you got arupa, I know why you have to go gradually to, and then it becomes a fetus. The definition of being fetter to it, the five upper fetters. But I can't see why must all arahant go through the five fetters, especially the part that is attained by four jhana. That's my puzzling for years and years.
Yeah. Oh, it's the nature of the only way that you can see things as they truly are is to have such, first of all, the job of the jhanas is to abandon the five hindrances. So you're not seeing things as you want to see them, as you, which are things which really challenge you, but no, literally as they truly are. The hindrances are gone, and secondly, you use the data which the jhanas give you. The things that you see, things are not just up and down, but totally vanish. They're nicha, not anymore. They're anicca. Things vanish, gone, which have always been there, and now they're not there anymore. The simile of the frog and the tadpole. And you see them fading away, ceasing. And therefore, you know, that so you see the power of relinquishing, letting go. But anyway, if that doesn't answer the question, we can talk about it afterwards, because it is now sort of a time for finishing off, because we're doing a little ceremony for Judy in about 10 minutes' time. So we now do the scene. That's why the bhikkhunis have come, I have supplied a few others. So we now do a little chant of, actually we do the bowing. So the Buddha and Samana, the Arahant Samana. Here we go.
Arahant Samana Sambuddho Bhagava. Buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi. Suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Suppatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.
I haven't put it in as my yam.
Okay, oh, that's fine. I can just give it here.
Okay.
Okay, we have a 10-minute break. Those of you who are going to come back for a little memorial service for Judy Rushforth. And
for the AV person, that if you have any questions from the internet from overseas, have you got a few questions from the internet?
Yes.
Can you please get up one or two, because have them to come up now as well. Internet questions, but this is just going to be for the people overseas. But anyway, be quick. Yeah, you can. Yeah. See the AV guy. Yeah. Okay, I've got to be quite fast. Okay. Okay. Yes. Okay. And those of you still.
Yes, it's good. Yeah.
Okay. So this is from the overseas here, from Nathan, and in USA, Malaysia, and again from USA. I don't understand the teaching of impermanence. Everything is impermanent, but nirvana is not. Correct, because nirvana is a ceasing of everything. Nothing left. Gone. So nirvana is the ending of stuff. A flame is impermanent, is uncertain, it comes and goes, but once it's out, where does it go? It goes nowhere. So it means that it's vanished, ceased, nothing left. So as they sometimes say, that nothing is higher than Jesus and God. And say, yes, of course, nothing is the highest. Emptiness, gone, finished, gone. So the teaching of impermanence, everything is impermanent, but nirvana is not. Nirvana is ceasing, gone. So not impermanent, permanent. None of those things obviously apply because it's gone, finished. Fourth satipatthana, having impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment of the four hindrances. Is this where the five hindrances are abandoned, not just restrained? The fourth satipatthana is just where we focus on these things. And the third satipatthana, or rather its expression in the Anapanasati Sutta of the 12th fact of Anapanasati, which is where the mind is liberated, that is the jhanas, that is where the five hindrances are gone for a while. They are suppressed, they are not there, but they come back afterwards. The place where the five hindrances are abandoned once and for all is in the experience of full enlightenment. And lastly, from New Hampshire, USA, how do the suttas help beyond just practicing compassion and kindness? The compassion and kindness and mindfulness are important parts of the path, but we always want to know where that path leads, and the suttas show that very clearly, the full picture of the big road map. And also, the suttas are our basic framework, so these are pretty clearly the teachings of the historical Buddha, and anyone who wishes to have that justified, argued, please get onto the internet. There was a book done, a compilation by Ajahn Sujato and Ajahn Brahmani called The Authenticity Project. Arguments from many areas which give a very convincing argument that what is in the suttas was the teaching of the Buddha. So it gives us a foundation of authority. You cannot take authority of a monk or a nun, nor a group of monks. Because as you know, that many monks, many nuns say many different things. And so, poor lay people, who do we believe? And so, at least you have these suttas, which you can actually investigate for yourself and find out from these suttas. Of course, then you have the problem of, yeah, you have the suttas, but, you know, translating them. So little by little, you can check on these translations, argue as much as you want, discuss as much as you want, and then we can actually find out what these suttas are really teaching. So thank you from overseas. Just had to go through those quickly because running out of a bit of time. So okay, so those who are going to stay for the little ceremony for...